Great. Let me introduce you to our illustrious panelists who really need no introduction, unlike some other people here like Elon Musk, who really needs to be labeled, but for, you know, the 1% of people who don't already have these as household names, it's my pleasure to introduce first Eliezer Yudkowsky, who is the founder of the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, which does theoretical research on the safe development of artificial intelligence. Eliezer is known best in some circles for writing the cult classic fan fiction, Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality, which just to give you a little context, my organization, Center for Applied Rationality, does workshops on training people in rationality skills. And back when I was doing the admissions interviews, I did like 100 of these. And one of the questions I always asked people was, how did you get interested in rationality? And I kid you not, at least half of the people said, well, I found this Harry Potter fan fiction one day, and it talked about rationality, and it was so interesting that I started investigating the ideas, and now I'm super into rationality. So go figure. I don't know how much of that was all part of some grand plan, but it seems to have worked out that way. Anyway, on Eliezer's left is Professor Rob Reich, who is a professor of political science at Stanford University. He's also the co-director of the Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society, and director of the Center for Ethics in Society. And Rob also frequently writes about philanthropy and sometimes about effective altruism in publications like the New York Times and the Boston Review.
And to say what's obvious now, I'm not the former labor secretary.
Right.
Yet, growth mindset.
Right. And last but certainly not least, we have Tim Urban, who got his degree from Harvard and then founded the website Wait But Why, where he is a writer and illustrator. Wait But Why is, it's a little hard to describe. It's long-form articles plus diagrams and pictures that are about artificial intelligence, psychology, philosophy, technology, life, the universe, and everything. And they manage to be simultaneously packed with information and insight and also super catchy and viral, which is not an easy combination to hit at once. Tim, according to his website, his areas of specialization include drawing stick figures at a fourth grade skill level, which used to say second grade skill level, which was crossed out, and now says fourth grade, so I guess your art has improved, which congratulations.
Getting better.
Yeah. So we're going to kick things off by inviting each of our panelists to do an up to 5-minute introduction, either to their work in communications or to a particular topic in the space of communications that they happen to be particularly interested in right now. And then after that, we will launch into discussion.
Yeah. I need to put something up on that screen somehow, so someone else can go first while I figure out how to do that.
Sounds good. Do we have a person who knows anything about AV? Yeah? Cool. Why don't you consult together? And Rob, do you want to start things off?
Sure. I'm going to stand up since I teach classes. I'm used to standing up in front of groups. Is that all right?
Sounds good.
For just a couple minutes to speak. You might think correctly that as my work experience is teaching classes at a university, I teach both graduate classes and undergraduate classes. And the main thing I want to say to you today is that I think when it comes to communicating complex ideas and concepts, the EAA community treats virtually all of its communications as if we were all in an advanced graduate seminar and is generally awful at engaging well-motivated, but beginner undergraduates as the equivalent. So I want to assume as the audience then that we wish to communicate to, if I want to make myself a member of the tribe, a well-motivated undergraduate beginner audience, and then posit the things I have to say with that as the background. We're all pretty good at communicating to the advanced graduate seminar. So just by way of illustration, I'm wearing a GiveWell t-shirt. I serve on the board of GiveWell. I'm obviously a fan of what GiveWell does, but their blog posts assume an unbelievable level of academic competence to figure out exactly what's being communicated. If you were someone, as I often do tell undergraduate students, go check out what Givall's recommendations. Sure, you can get the rank ordering and understand these three charities, but if you want to understand the reasoning and you thought the blog posts were the main method of taking that on board, you have to go get a PhD in economics to begin to understand some of that, and that's a mistake, I think, not necessarily of GiveWell's, but of the EAA community in general. So here's my background sort of pedagogical thought with respect to how to engage an undergraduate audience, or for that matter, even an advanced audience, but nevertheless, here's what I aim to do. You have to understand something about where their heads are. There's a fancy term for this. You want to engage the zone of proximal development, which is to say, you can't begin to teach effectively unless you have a sense already about where students' heads are. And then what you want to do is you want to nudge them to a space of what I call productive discomfort. You want to have pressed them enough to begin to become uncomfortable with their own internal values, expectations, reflect on their behavior, and to think there's some gap now between what they're being shown or argued and what their lives are actually like, but not so uncomfortable that they flee from you and never return. So I could give you the historical explanation for this. My model, if you will, is Socrates, who went around looking to engage people in uncomfortable conversation. Of course, his story doesn't end well. They eventually put him to death because it was so uncomfortable for enough people that it became a problem. You have to figure out a way to engage people so that they're productively uncomfortable, not unproductively uncomfortable. So, a few things which I've just picked out of my, you know, sort of casual tour around the EA community that I would argue against. I feel like a skunk at the party here a little bit already, but if we're about complex communication, complex ideas, I think this needs to be said. All right, so lesson number one, point number one, stop for an undergraduate beginner audience a kind of cultish obsession with rank ordering the goodness or badness of a set of acts we already conceive to be as good things. So, Is it really necessary to engage a beginner audience by trying to argue whether or not donating a kidney altruistically to a stranger is better than adopting 20 children, as Larissa McFarker just described, or to give money to GiveWell's three recommended charities? All three of those things are really, really good things to do, and engaging an undergraduate audience, a beginner audience, with saying it's really important to figure out how to rank order them is going to be hugely alienating and a mistake. Second point, here's a kind of ordinary insight. It's really good about rationality. Rational argument has to rest at the base of anything that is productive discussion, in my view, certainly in a classroom setting. But nevertheless, story and narrative is essential to that in an ongoing conversational context. So I'll posit to you that if you think about who's had a greater effect in mobilizing as a movement more people, Michael Pollan or Peter Singer in the book about food, Michael Pollan wins by a long shot, even though the philosophical argument, with some modest differences, is expressed most clearly by Singer. To continue my role as a skunk of the party, if Will McCaskill is in the room, apologies to him. I've just met him for the first time. I will predict Will McCaskill, McCaskill's new book, which I had, but is now in the back of the room. You all have too, I'm sure. Will be less effective in mobilizing a broad community than Larissa McFarker's book, which is due to come out next month. Partly, Larissa's just a fantastic writer, but she's writing in a way trying to engage people who aren't initially looking for rational argument about rank ordering the best acts that they could do. Third point, there's a tendency with this undergraduate audience to engage them as if all of human life is an optimization problem. And what you're trying to do is solve for maximal efficiency in all of your activity. Your ordinary person just does not think like that. And yeah. I'm not against the approach, so this is not a criticism. It's a criticism only if you think leading with that to an undergraduate audience, a beginner audience, is going to have huge take-up. It'll have huge take-up in a grad student community, the EA community, not within a broad community that you're looking to draw on board. All right, fourth and finally, a familiar thing. One thing I think that, in particular, both Will McCaskill's book and any broad-minded EA is good at doing is not erecting a kind of wall between reason and emotion. It's absolutely both philosophically possible, morally commendable, and humanly understandable to be extremely passionate and moved emotionally by what you're committed to rationally. And so insofar as one of the messages of EA is reason should cabin and suppress our emotion, I don't think that's either a good communication strategy or, for that matter, philosophically correct and defensible. I'll stop there.
Excellent. Thank you, Rob.
All right. Hello. I'm going to just stay seating here, and I also probably should have made slides, but I didn't, so I'll just tell you what they would have said. When Julia reached out and asked me to be on a panel about communicating complex concepts, I started by just thinking, okay, so as far as my own experience doing so, why do I do it? What's the goal? What's the good that can come out of it? And how do I do it? When I've been most effective, what am I doing that's effective? And when I have missed the mark, why? So. I would have two slides. The first one would say, more awareness equals good. And so that's kind of my why communicate complex concepts reason. And what I mean by that is I wrote one post on this kind of framework for thinking that I'm working on as a human that kind of breaks down awareness or different, different semantic, wording you can use. You can say levels of consciousness. You can say, levels of knowledge. But whatever it is, I'm calling it awareness. That there's actually distinct levels of awareness that any human can be on. And awareness means self-awareness, awareness of history and science and the context and what's happening in the time we're living, what the time we're living, the context around it, and what role it plays in the broader time, and what are the implications of the things that are happening in the time we're living. So that kind of awareness. And to me, more of that is going to make the world a better place. I think it's one of the most surefire ways to improve the world is to build awareness in that way. And I think that the opposite is, an example of this concept is the opposite of awareness, is ignorance and delusion. And I think we can all say that a lot of the bad in the world, bad things that happen, come from ignorance and delusion. And truly clear-headed people that are seeing the world for what it is and understand the context, I think are much more likely to do good. And I think in that way, altruism is actually a byproduct of awareness more than a cause in itself. It's an effect of an increased awareness. It's a symptom of something that you need to be actually going to the roots of in order to build that altruism. So I use Elon Musk as an example. There's no one in my experience that is more clear-headed than Elon Musk. I think that part of his genius is that he just has an unusual way of just seeing everything for exactly how they are down to the first principles and understanding where it all fits in and seeing the big picture. If it's concentric circles, his circle's very, very large. So of course he's living his life in an altruistic way, because once you get to that level, it's very obvious. It becomes the only logical thing to do when you're that clear-headed. And so someone who's thinking so clearly, he says, well, we probably should make human life multiplanetary because we're going to go extinct otherwise. We're all in one basket here. All the eggs are in one basket. He can just see that so clearly. So obviously he would do the right thing there. And so that's, I guess, the starting point for me is just, as a blogger, one thing I can do to help. I wouldn't say that the point of Wait But Why is altruism necessarily, but I think that one way it can be altruistic is it can help build awareness and that can lead other people to maybe act more altruistic. And so the second slide would say, would get to how I try to do it, how I try to communicate ideas in order to build awareness. And that slide would say, target yourself. And so what I mean by that is, I think that as far as how to get ideas across and how to motivate people or how to do anything you're trying to do to affect other people, I think it's a real nice thing to know that there's 7.3 billion people, which means that that there's all different kinds of people. And the fact is, yes, you're all special snowflakes, you're all unique, but there's also kind of 100,000 duplicates of each of you out there in the world. And that's a fact that I've really absorbed, where I feel like I'm writing for a bunch of Tims. And that's the approach I take. So I don't need any focus group or anything like that to say, how do I get this across? I looked in my own head and I said, well, how do I understand it? What's confusing to me? And there are my answers are right there. And so one of the best compliments I can get about a post is when someone says, oh, this guy's in my head, you're in my head. I said, no, I'm in my head and you're just me. And you know, it's those times when I've dug deep into my own psychology that I find I can make, I really, you know, it's like you get 10x the impact when someone's like, oh my God, he's saying exactly what I think, versus when someone's like, oh, that's an interesting point of view. And the way you get to that oh my God level is just by, you know, figuring out what's going on in your own head, because that's how you understand what's going on in so many others. Not that everyone is me, it's just that 7.3 billion people, there's a lot of people that are, and I can start there. There's, you know, if I affect that many people out there, that's a great, great start. That's the low-hanging fruit. That's where I know how the Tims out there, I know what their insecurities are, what their fears are, what excites them. I know what makes them tick. So that's what I do. And as a blogger, when you do that, blog becomes like flypaper, no matter what you do. And the flies that stick to the blog and end up coming back are the ones that happen to like it, happen to like what you're writing. So you'll end up collecting all of the yous out there by being authentic. And
30 more seconds.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, I told her to yank me off. I also am the one who, by the way, told her to say that we need no introductions. And that was my request. Anyway, so I've had a chance to write about artificial intelligence, and recently I've had a chance to work with Elon Musk and write about his stuff. And I just see my role is to look at those things and say, I've been hearing a lot about it. I wish I knew more. Okay, that tells me that all the Tims out there have been hearing a lot about it. They all wish they knew more. This is, wow, this is mind-blowing. Okay, they're going to find this mind-blowing. And that's the approach I take, and I go from there.
Excellent. New life hack I just learned. You don't actually have to make slides. You can just describe what they would have looked like. It will save me so much time. All right, so Eliezer has a somewhat different kind of presentation, I think.
All right, so let's hope that I can figure out how to flop this thing. Okay, you'll flop it back. All right, excellent. Okay, so last night, I asked my wife Brienne, like, which of these like 15 different things should I try to cover in my five minute opening talk? She was like, pick one thing that people will be able to do at the end of your talk that they couldn't do before, and have them practice it during the 5 minute talk. So the thing that I've picked is the ideological Turing test, invented by Brian Kaplan. This is because your ability to put yourself into other people's minds, not your mind where you already know the arguments and what you think is the conclusion, people who haven't heard the arguments, people who haven't arrived at the same conclusion, and put yourself into their heads and imagine what they think of your words, is a base level skill that all other communication calls upon. It's not the only skill, but it's like an extremely basic skill. One way of testing whether you are as smart or as like otherwise contain something inside yourself is to see whether judges can tell the difference between something you wrote pretending to be, someone who like believes that all money should be donated to symphony orchestras, versus like your actual self. See if a judge can tell who's the real person who believes this and who's faking it. That's the ideological Turing test. And unfortunately, the URL isn't showing properly, but it's blacker.caltech.edu/ITT. So I want everyone with a computer or cell phone to go to Blacker, Blacker, .caltech.edu/ITT and spend 3 minutes pretending to be someone who believes the opposite of whatever you believe about option one, astronomical stakes, option two, animal altruism. And we're not going to do it during this episode, but like afterwards, you can come back to this page and look and try to judge the entries and see like how you can do at distinguishing people who actually believe something from people who are just pretending to believe it. I want everyone to practice writing something that they disagree with, and I already had some other people. No, I already had some other people add entries that they agree with. So, also in all right. Blacker.caltech.edu/ITT. All right. Go. All right. Down pencils or equivalent thereof. If it was like totally incomplete, you can like come back after the talk, finish your entry, see what's already there, and see if you can tell the difference between like the ones that I had seated that are like true positions versus like the ones that were submitted here. And besides the like base skill that you all hopefully just like tried to use, the other lesson is like to convey a complex concept, you sometimes have to convey a skill. To convey a skill, you have to give people a way to practice it.
Nice meta message there. Very appropriate for the group. Thank you, Eliezer. So, and you'll have the results up here if people want to go see how they...
Yeah, you can go to judge entries and review submissions.
Great.
You probably have that taken down so people aren't tempted to... Thanks.
To do it right now. Thank you. So all of us in different way, all of our panelists have touched on the idea of understanding or misunderstanding. And this is a topic that's been on my mind a lot as I do a lot of communicating as well, or trying to communicate. And this one study keeps coming back to my mind. It's a study from, I think, 1990 or thereabouts. And a psychologist split people into two groups and asked people in the first group to pair up with someone from the second group. And she gave them a song like Happy Birthday or Old MacDonald Had a Farm or something like that, and asked them to tap the song to their partner. So like, let me try to do one. I don't know if any of you could hear that. No? All right, well, those in the front row. Did anyone know what song I was?
Happy Birthday.
Oh no, that was the Star Spangled Banner. well, anyway, so this is a representative case because only about 1 in 40 of the listeners could guess what song was being tapped. And she also asked the tappers to guess, what do you think are the chances your partner will get the song right? And the average probability they stated was 50%. So that's quite a disparity there. And the principle it's illustrating, or the phenomenon, is that when you have the song in your head, like I'm hearing Star Spangled Banner as I'm tapping, it's really hard to imagine what that tapping sounds like to someone who isn't hearing the same song in your head. And I think this is a great metaphor. It's barely even a metaphor for communication in general of concepts or you know arguments. And so I'm curious actually to hear how Tim's going to answer this question, because I find that when I assume my audience, or even when I have good reason to believe my audience thinks similarly to me, there are all these misunderstandings I never would have predicted. Plenty of jokes that I make that people don't realize are jokes. You know, I say something like, well, none of this matters anyway, because probably the singularity will happen tomorrow. And some people think I'm not joking. or I just, you know, misestimate the position that people started out from, and so I failed to nudge them in the right direction. Like, I was giving an informal talk about vaccines and autism, and I was saying how, you know, it's such a travesty because so many children's lives and health are at stake. And this guy in my audience was vociferously agreeing with me, and he was saying, oh, it's just terrible, you know, that the irresponsibility, the immorality involved. And I was like, oh, yes, it's absolutely terrible. I completely agree. And eventually he said, yeah, and you know, can you believe the cover-up that's happening among the pharmaceuticals? And I was like, yeah, wait, what? And then I realized we'd been coming at this from totally different sides of the debate. So anyway, the question that I want to start with could be either, what kinds of misunderstandings have you encountered when you've tried to get your message across? Or if you like, you could answer, what kinds of misunderstandings do you think EA, the effective altruist movement, has run up against or is running up against? So feel free to jump in, anyone who has thoughts.
I love the Happy Birthday Star Spangled Banner thing. I think it's a great metaphor for, there's some people that just have a talent for teaching. I'm sure as a professor, you're constantly having to think about what they're hearing with the tapping and not what you already know, because you know so much more than your students. So the way I would say, I mean, if you look at, if you've ever been on Weibo and you look at the comment section, not everyone agrees with me, for sure. But that's not really what I'm concerned about. It's much more this happy birthday thing. I'm still writing for a bunch of me's, but the way I deal with the fact that I know more than my readers in certain areas is by thinking about, I actually have access to lots of Tims. I have access to 29-year-old Tim, 25-year-old Tim, 21-year-old Tim, 5-year-old Tim. Those, I dig into those people too. So, for example, with AI, I knew nothing about it other than from watching movies. So when I researched that, all I had to do when I was writing that is remember what Tim 3 weeks ago thought and write for him. I'm writing to that guy who before I researched. But when I'm writing about SpaceX and I just did a section on all the planets, and I knew the diameter of Mercury when I was 3. Because I'm obsessed with planets. So there I had to dig into, a long time ago, the kind of thing that would have blown my mind when I was 7, because I happen to know. So the key for me is calibrating where understanding, being able to picture what an average curious person would, where they would be, and then where I am, and being able to know how much higher or lower, and then dig into a Tim back when I was there. And that's the way I deal with it. But I think being aware of that is incredibly important. And I've missed it sometimes, and that's what does help, just getting a proofreader, someone saying, I, you lost me there, and my immediate reaction is always like, no, you're dumb, because I'm all like attached to my writing, and then I'm like, no, okay, if they said that, that's not just them, they're thinking that, I probably missed the mark. So.
And we only have one mic between the three panelists, so you'll have to pass it along.
So what I think of as sort of like the second phase of my attempt to write popular science, began in, I think it would have been 2003 or thereabouts, where I was like discoursing on the wonders of Bayes' theorem and how it is the secret of the universe in an IRC channel. And like a person I knew who'd like been sort of like hanging out with like the mailing list I was on was like, yes, yes, secret of the universe, wonderful, wonderful. And then like a bit later on, like I tried to like ask him how to use Bayes' theorem to apply like the probability that something is a banana given that it's yellow. And they didn't know how to like distinguish between probability of banana given yellow and probability of yellow given banana. And that was when I like suddenly had this epiphany. I realized why schools existed and homework. It wasn't just a credentialing filter mechanism. Like there was actually a point to all the homework. And I set out on my like next journey to like explain Bayes' theorem so well that an eighth grader could understand it, and failed miserably. And the like next iteration of that, like I like had some people like to act as graphic artists and was like trying to build this like, okay, like this time for real, like Bayes' theorem. I wasn't really aiming at eighth graders anymore, but like med students. I can at least get med students to understand Bayes' theorem this way. And like I had a test reader. And like every time I showed it to the test reader, like I needed to expand a new section. And the whole thing like got larger and larger and larger until the project failed. And there's like sort of two morals here. Moral number one, the simplest way to find out whether you're committing the transparency illusion is to find a test subject and give them a test, hence the phrase test subject. Well, find a test subject, try to explain it to them, and then like sort of ask a question that you think might discriminate whether they understood or not. And the other moral is like, it takes time to learn these things, so start early. And, well, third moral, tools matter. But maybe I'll say more about that part later.
Do you want to give the topic sentence?
Tools matter. The reason my project bogged down was that, like, my tool for presenting my explanation of Bayes was a linear web page. And, like, I need to go beyond linear web pages, but I didn't actually have, like, web development capability donated to me back then.
Excellent.
I'll just add a quick additional word about this. So again, on the assumption that what one is trying to communicate is to a beginner audience, not to an advanced audience, someone already previously in dialogue with you about trying to work out sort of downstream or more sophisticated positions. I wasn't in the session earlier, but Dylan Matthews said something like, thinking about effective altruism is part and parcel of thinking about what it is to be a human. So in that respect, which I think is entirely correct, getting people thinking about the very subject matter that we all care deeply about is not an especially difficult thing to do, because it goes along with thinking about what it means to live a good life, what it means to figure out some elementary things about how you project into your future, about what you're going to do with your profession, think about how you're going to allocate your time and talent, and if you want to, your money as well. And beginning with those elemental things and understanding that people really do want conversation about that, and that conversation is dialogical, which is why a lecture format for the kinds of things that I think we do, so long as we're in person, but this also can be mediated online, of course. Dialogue is essential. It's not a one-way communication in a lecture setting so that I can, or you can, dispense the pearls of wisdom that effective altruism has come to as if they were elemental proofs or truths that simply, once given the conclusion, now will be immediately recognized as such by someone who's a beginner. Dialogue is an essential mechanism for that, beginning with something as simple and elemental as, what kind of life do you want to live? What kind of human do you want to be? And it's the age-old Socratic question.
Thanks. I just remembered one more example of comedic misunderstanding. I was making a rhetorical point about buying animal products, and I was asking why in our society is it considered acceptable to eat animals when we don't technically need to, but it's not considered acceptable to have sex with animals. You know, the argument against bestiality that you often hear is, well, the animal can't consent. Well, I mean, the animal can't consent to being killed and eaten either. And so I made this point. I thought I was being perfectly clear, and then I got an email from a guy saying, oh, it's so cool to meet a girl who will admit that she's into bestiality. Here, I sent you some links. I think you'll enjoy these. So, yeah, word to the wise.
Like additional comic stories. So I once published a page, a certain argument about like which is worse for a certain extremely large number of people to get dust specks in their eyes or for one person to be tortured. Now, the number that I used for the number of people who got dust specks in their eyes was actually like a number that like only mathematicians would recognize on site and required a lengthy explanation of exactly how large this number was, like way larger than a Google, way larger than 10 to a Google. So like years later, this of course like provoked much indignation among people who couldn't understand how large the number was. Like some people were indignant for other reasons, but now you go online, you like say like, look, let me explain how stupid this is. Like, so this person had like a very large number of dust specks, right? It's around a billion. And I will now calculate like how much pain each of that is and add it up and compare it to the condition of the person being tortured. See, the person being tortured is worse. And the moral of the story was, like, I should have used a Googleplex. I should have used 10 to a Google. Because I used a number vastly larger than that, it slipped out of people's buffers and got approximated as a billion.
In other news, I just got why this building is called the Googleplex. Thank you. we've talked a little bit about clarity or lack of clarity, and I think it might be a good point now to go into, assuming you can make your message clear and understood, how do you make it memorable? How do you make it sticky? And ideally, how do you make it the sort of thing that people remember and care about enough to want to pass on to other people, whether that's making an article go viral or... Eliezer has ended up inventing or coining so many phrases that are just in the air now, in some circles anyway. I like find myself using them, you know, approximately once a day. Or how do you, you know, get your students to remember stuff, not just after the final, but, you know, once they go out into the world? So that's the prompt. How do you make stuff sticky and memorable? Do you have any recommendations?
Don't use contrived philosophical thought experiments involving people being tortured. It works great on the memorability dimension, but has unfortunate side effects on the discourse.
I just wanted to say, my friends and I have taken to adapting philosophical thought experiments that involve things like torture or, you know, eternal suffering, and changing them so it's, instead of torture, you don't get cake. Or something like that. And the problems are isomorphic, but less like psychologically upsetting.
this is just going to be continuous with what I said before. I mean, I see the kinds of things that effective altruism wishes to communicate as, at its absolute fundamental level, a question about morality, and that won't seem any surprise to any of you. And so part of what it seems to me in communicating about morality and being in dialogue about morality is that what you want to do is, again, push people to a kind of zone of productive discomfort where they begin to think maybe the kinds of things that were implicit that I couldn't give a label to, now that they're explicit, and I think, am I really on board with that? And you want to create a space of at least internal contradiction and uncertainty, confusion, possibly even shame, so that when they leave the conversation, what ends up sticking with them is, huh, I thought I was a good person, and now I'm not so sure anymore. And I'm going to have to continue to think about that because I want to put myself in moral rectitude. I want to feel like I have a sensibility about what it means to live a good life. And the conversation that I just had makes me wonder whether or not the path I'd been on is actually the one I should be on.
I have a question about that, unless you want to jump in first.
Well,
go ahead.
I have two things that I think would, like, when you say sticky or memorable, that, because I'm always trying to do that. I'm always trying to figure out, it's like a hole with a bucket in it. If you're not, it's useless. Even if you inspire someone for a day, and if they forget it, it doesn't matter. So two things I try to do. One is, I mean, if you, I can tell you basically every word, every, like, shuffle of the tie of David Brent on The Office because I like the show so much. I can, like, I know I've committed basically the entire thing to memory, not having seen it 20 times, just seen it once or twice, but it was entertaining and I loved it at the time and it struck a chord, so I remember it. Do I remember a random class from sophomore year of college or, like, around the same time I watched that? No. And so for me, it's just like writing, communicating a complex nonfiction idea should be thought of in the same way as how great entertainment happens or how fiction happens. And if you make it funny, or if you make it, if you put in cliffhangers and you make it suspenseful, or if you just whatever you can do to make it a really enjoyable experience learning, it should be really fun. Then more people, of course, you get more viral, but also people who read it will remember it more. That's the first thing. The second thing I would say I try to do is just make sure that there's a, I use this analogy that I've stolen from somewhere else, but a knowledge is like a tree, and if you have a really strong tree trunk, then everything you learn gets added onto it, and it continues to add on. But if you don't have a tree trunk, if you don't have that foundation of basic knowledge about something, you can read all the articles you want that are higher level. You can learn all the information. The leaves and branches you learn won't have anything to hang on to, and they fall away. So I'm always trying to, without being patronizing in my writing, is make sure that readers have a tree trunk. And usually that starts with me thinking about whether I have one. And I just know that's the way that that anything can start to stick then. Because then the topic becomes interesting and it has a place to hang on to and context to build on to.
Did you want to jump in?
Did you want to ask your question before it falls off the stack and then I'll respond to that?
I have questions piling up now. shoot, it fell off the stack. It'll come back.
So let me take that and run with it. And in particular, there's a very influential sentence I once read, which is nonfiction conveys knowledge, fiction conveys experiences. But why is it so much more effective to convey experience than knowledge to whatever? I mean, you can do that in nonfiction too, actually. What is the difference? And I think that one of the factors there, so one of the factors is probably just sort of engagement of the senses. The more senses you engage, the more on a sheer neurological level, the more chance you have to form associations that fix it in memory. But another factor is, I think, a sort of concrete thinking about things that would otherwise be in the realm of airy abstraction to the point where no one ever visualized an example of them. Some of the most effective atheistic writing I've ever read is fantasy novels in which the gods are real. And the gods behave like the gods in religions do. And because you're thinking about this in the mode of the main character who is actually right there dealing with the god being a jerk, a thing that was that seemed sort of okay when it was airy and abstract, as an experienced lived through, suddenly takes on a very different meaning. The big problem with artificial intelligence is that so many of these things are abstract, and I try to make them concrete as much as I can, but
even so, there are gaps remaining. Like in terms of how, like, what can you do to, about this to like be a more effective communicator? Like when you have an abstract argument, like try to write a story about it, even if only inside your own head. Live the life of a person facing that problem, dealing with that dilemma, making that choice, being the person affected by the choice. Even if you aren't actually writing a Harry Potter Potter fan fiction about it, live it inside your own mind, maybe even write the story on a computer somewhere to make sure that your brain knows the concrete parts of it.
Can I add something?
Eliezer just gave for me what is the background to the view I expressed earlier that Larissa McFarker's work will be a much broader touchstone for the average person with respect to effective altruism than Will McCaskill's book. And it's not because I think the work that Will did in the book is in any way unimportant. It's absolutely essential, but it's the nonfiction presentation of knowledge as opposed to human portraiture of life, where the life itself that's drawn in Larissa McFarker's work constitutes itself a kind of argument. And that resonates with people. The stories about the human beings in Larissa McFarker's book, I would predict, will resonate and be remembered much longer than the abstract arguments that are contained in Will's book, as important as those are. I don't want to be misunderstood that Will made a mistake in writing the book. He should have tried to do nonfiction portraiture. We want a diversity of different approaches. And it's just to endorse what Eliezer said about wanting certain types of fictional or at least creative nonfiction approaches to give embodied life to abstract argument.
Thank you. So one problem, I'm quite on board with the, you know, making the abstract concrete and visceral and compelling, but I also feel torn about it because there are so many examples of fiction leaving people with the wrong, like people infer the wrong things from fiction, or they update too much from fictional evidence or something like that. So, you know, people who promote the concept of the importance of AI safety will often complain about movies like The Terminator giving people, you know, a very sticky but like probably not very representative picture of what it would look like to have superintelligence. And I've seen this with other sort of more philosophical fiction, where I come away, like there are features of the story that are not essential to the logic or to the argument, but they're very sticky. And so I come away with those and I have to sort of work hard to remember, no, the actual argument is this sort of bare skeleton, and all of the things that happened in the story aren't necessary to the argument. So especially with regard to Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality, but everyone else feel free to jump in as well. How do you, like, do you worry about that? And if so, do you do anything to avoid it?
So the counter skill to this, I would say, is relevance. When you have like a very abstract sort of concept, and you like sort of want to make an experience about it, there's a way of bouncing off the problem, which is to introduce something that is vivid and experienced, and not central to the abstract idea plot. So for example. That would have been if I'd written Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality to have Harry Potter and Draco Malfoy getting together in their basement to like study a science textbook that didn't like have any important like where what science they studied, changing that science would not have changed the larger plot of the story. Even if like their friendship had been bonded over reading the science textbook together, the fact that I could change which science was in the textbook and not change the larger plot is the problem of like sort of telling the wrong story, giving the wrong message, making the wrong thing memorable. In the Terminator stories, the robots with glowing red eyes, like the problem isn't so much that there are robots with glowing red eyes, it's that there's no robots being smarter than the humans. That causes people to get the wrong idea of which part of like the stakes in AI are very high. And like I think that there sort of like is no way to address this problem just by being very abstract. That means that none of the ideas stick in people's minds. You just have to write the right fiction and like make the true science actually relevant to the plot.
Let me give one example from Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality. Some people, this is a very popular fan fiction, but some people start reading HPMOR and find the character of Harry Potter to come off as a little cocky, maybe, a little arrogant, perhaps. And because he's sort of the paragon of rationality in the book, people, I mean...
Since when?
Well, he's an exemplar of the use cases of rationality.
Of the cocky young rationalist who like eventually has a ton of reality drop on him and has to truly begin his journey for the first time.
Okay, so maybe the problem is that they don't finish the book then.
But yeah, so like that, I think that was just pure illusion. I think that was just pure illusion of transparency. That was like botched on my end. I just completely failed to understand for the conceptual gap of the person who is reading this with no idea of like what is supposed to be the literary meaning of this character, which existed only in my own head.
Any other thoughts about fictional evidence, or should I go on?
A 10-second thought is just that I think that fiction is going to both be written by people who are trying to convey a real message and by people who are trying to entertain. And those people might make a movie that is completely misrepresentative of what AI actually is for the sake of entertainment, and that's not a bad thing to do. That's okay. Fiction can be anything. That's why it's fiction. So I do think, but I think that if people are educated on what AI is, then they'll be able to quickly point out that's not real, that's real. Like they can about a lot of topics when they see fiction. So I don't think we can rely on fiction to be accurate and be mad at the Terminator, because fiction is allowed to do whatever it wants. I just think that, you know, if you build awareness, then people can discern for themselves as well.
Great. We have a few minutes left, and I want to make sure we touch on the question of or the topic of different ways of framing EA messages, because if it wasn't clear already, framing is pretty core to communicating your message and making it stick and not having people take it the wrong way, et cetera. And I've noticed a lot of framing debates or challenges in the EA space so far. For example, a lot of EA articles or op-eds will latch onto a very controversial or talked about topic, like Cecil the Lion most recently, but there was also Batkid in San Francisco last year or 2 years ago. There was the Ice Bucket Challenge, and so the EA articles will sort of grab onto the fact that people are paying attention to this, which is a great hook. And then they'll say, look, you know, we should instead be paying attention to this thing, or like, actually, you know, this heartwarming story of Batkid isn't a very effective way to be altruistic, etc. And I think there's a bunch of other, like even just the core message of EA, if it's not, you know, talking about a particular topical issue, can often come across as very critical, where it's saying, you know, don't care about that, care about this, or don't give to that charity, give to this charity. Especially in light of what Rob was saying about causing people to feel a discomfort or shame to the extent that you might actually change their mind, it feels to me that there's a tension or a trade-off there, and I'm wondering if you think there's a way around that trade-off or a way to do it well.
I agree with that. I think this is a part of the impulse to go right away to a kind of rank-ordering exercise about whose act is more consistent with the EA framework. And instead, I think an alternative framework is, I mean, partly what I think Will McCaskill does extremely well in the opening chapter of the book, which is how shockingly easy it is for modest things that all human beings can do tomorrow that will make a significant contribution to improving the welfare of other human beings. It's not something about moral heroism or sainthood. It's not something in which there's deep sacrifice to oneself tomorrow all the time. It's incremental steps forward that are easy to do once one begins to grapple with the problem and feels like it's part and parcel of living an ordinary good life. And the key there is ordinary, and not as if you have to jump over some massive chasm in order to join the small community of EA people who are out there on the moral paragon of the island that you want to be with ultimately, but it's just too big a leap from the beginning to get there.
Other thoughts?
A little bit of a broken record here, but I mean, to me, it's rather than, I don't want to have to rely on someone being a compassionate or loving or altruistic-minded person. Lots of perfectly good people just aren't. They're just focused on other things. And I think that if you want to have the broadest effect, you need to do things in a way that will appeal to even will make even non-altruistic people act altruistic. So again, to bring up Elon Musk, I'm very much drinking the Kool-Aid these days. You know, he doesn't say buy a Tesla because you should care about the future and your the children and all. He says buy a Tesla because I made the best car in the world. So people will buy a Tesla. He doesn't say we should, well, this is going to maybe be a little bit in the future. He doesn't say we should go to Mars because it's important so that 300 years from now, humanity's still around, because most people just in their hearts don't actually care. What he says is go to Mars because it's going to be the best adventure in history. That's what, you know, you're going to hear a lot of this in like 8 years. So I just think that that for me, the way to frame it is to, you know, if someone kicks a dog on the street, everyone is furious at that person. They're not. Everyone's altruistic about that because they're aware of what it means to be kicked as a biological creature, and they think that's wrong. But if you're not aware of the of what's right and wrong about AI or something like that, you're not going to necessarily have that natural "you shouldn't do that" kick in. So I just, again, comes back to me just educating as many people as possible about the facts of the time we're in, and just to have them all think as big and as clear-headed as possible.
We have a couple minutes left. I want to give our panelists an opportunity for any closing thoughts. Is there an important point that just didn't fit into any of my questions, et cetera? I think Eliezer has something.
So the title is Communicating Complex Concepts. I think that like we lack good tools for communicating complex concepts. The reason why you go to Wikipedia and you like can't learn about Bayes' theorem from Wikipedia, so like we can think of features that would make that easier. We can think of, we can imagine there being tabs on the wiki page containing like explanations at different technical levels. We can imagine like hovering over a link on the wiki page and having like a one paragraph summary of what's behind the link pop up and being able to click through to that. A friend of mine named Alexei Andreev is doing a startup to create a tool that I envision for, among other things, communicating complex concepts. It is my Wikipedia/Reddit/Tumblr/peer review replacement that some of you may have heard me talking about already. And if anyone in this audience happens to be like a EA full stack engineer who's passionate about that, or like a experienced startup person looking to become a co-founder for something like that, come over and talk to me to see if you're like sort of aligned with that project and you want to create the, among other things, communicating complex concepts tool.
I'm just going to repeat one thing, which is that I would wish for this community especially, which holds out so much hope for creating enormous good in the world, to devote more attention to communicating to a beginner audience, because you're exceptionally good, we're exceptionally good at finding different spaces and different places in which to push forward the frontier of our thinking, but not to induct new people into it.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say that I, just from my own experience, I'm much more effective as a human when I'm really doing what I deep down actually care about. And I think with altruism, it's a big, broad term, and I think that a lot of people feel like they should be putting their time towards one kind or another. And if deep down you don't really care and you don't want to admit that to anyone, but it's not you're fighting for some cause that, you know, you just in the end you would choose to like have some minor benefit for your own life over that cause actually getting better because you don't actually care. In those situations, like, that's not the right kind of altruism for you, and you shouldn't feel guilty about it. You should be more creative and think about what really gets you, what really does bring out that passion where you want to think about it. You just find yourself thinking about it all the time. That's the key. And if you find that, and then target, assume that there's 100,000 of you out there and you know exactly how to motivate yourself, so you know how to motivate them, I think that's the right starting point.
All right, how much time do we have left? Can I do a last three sentences? Okay, thank you. I'll close by answering my own question. If I could leave you all with one message about communication, I would say be a communications consequentialist, which is a phrase that I think my brother Jesse Galef might have coined. But oh, great! There you are. I didn't know you're here. But basically,
Jesse Galef is your brother.
I think that there's a temptation, you know, when someone doesn't get your sarcasm, or someone like comes away from your article believing X, even though you had a whole paragraph about how you were not saying X. To take one colorful example, the American Atheists put up a billboard. I'm stealing this example from Jesse. They put up a billboard a few years ago quoting a passage from the Bible endorsing slavery. The point, of course, was the Bible should not be the moral arbiter of our time, but people came away from it, some people, thinking that the atheists were endorsing slavery. And I think that the reaction to things like this is to say, and it was with many of the atheists in this case, the reaction is, oh, well, they should have known better. Like, they should have gotten it. And that's a very tempting reaction, but I think it's not a very useful reaction because, you know, whether or not you want to call people morons or think that they're morons for not getting your message, it doesn't matter for your goals of getting your message out or of educating people. And you just got to ask, all right, what can I do to, you know, forget blame, what can I do to maximize the chance that my message is heard and understood and remembered going forward? And on that note, I think I'll hand the floor over to Braden again.
Wow, thank you, amazing panelists. This was incredible, guys. Please give them a round of applause.